I'm Scott.
I'm Bill.
And we're the Trade Guys.
You're listening to The Trade Guys, a podcast produced by CSIS where we talk about trade in terms that everyone can understand. I'm H. Andrew Schwartz, and I'm here with Scott Miller and Bill Reinsch, the CSIS Trade Guys.
On this week's episode, Bill and I talk about USMCA and some disputes that are happening at the moment, as well as U.S. shipbuilding and the challenge of China. We'll cover these topics and more on today's episode of The Trade Guys. Thanks for listening.
Hi, Trade Guys. Good to be back. Andrew had a good streak going. I was starting to worry I wouldn't make it on again, but here I am. It's good to see you both. Let's first talk about an agreement that's giving us a bit less to discuss than other recent developments in the trade world right now, because it's seemingly yielding more substantive results. I'm talking about USMCA. But we are now seeing some developments in the steel sector, as well as the agreement's novel rapid response mechanism, which we'll both discuss in a moment. But first, guys, can you give us, at the 40,000-foot level, your take on USMCA? Is it turning out to be an effective, functional trade agreement?
Well, I think so. There's been the main element of, I don't know if contention is the right word, but the main element of focus has been the what you just referred to, Tipo, the rapid response mechanism, which is a tool for enforcing complaints about Mexican companies' treatment of their workers, their labor issues. And I think they're up to, what, nine or so complaints. And it appears to me that the process is working. You know, it produces outcomes. The Mexican government reacts. I think it helps that the current Mexican president is pro-worker, and I think believes in what this provision is designed to accomplish. A Mexican president that has different views, it might have been more complicated. But I think it's working, and there seems to be results. You know, independent unions are being elected in some places. That particular issue has run into a bit of a minefield right now, because there's one rapid response mechanism that we tried to start with respect to a mine in Mexico that the Mexican government is contesting. So it's gone to a panel per the agreement, and we'll see how that works out. The disagreement is kind of interesting. It's not about whether or not something bad is happening. It's about timing. And the Mexican government's argument is that the offensive actions in question happened and began before the USMCA agreement was reached. And the agreement is prospective, so that the rapid response mechanism does not apply, Mexico argues, to pre-existing problems before the agreement. The U.S. argues, based on a different clause in the agreement, that they can legitimately bring this case. So we'll see how the panel settles it. But that's, you know, that's a small bump along the way. I think for the most part, that is working well. But it's also fair to note, as I'm sure Scott will, that this has not erased some of the eternal bilateral problems. We still fight with them about tomatoes. We're fighting with them about corn. And we're fighting with them about oil and gas. Those are, the current big three. And they've been the big three for a while. So it hasn't solved every problem, but I think it's working.
Yeah, I would say that, first of all, USMCA is 95% or so NAFTA, and NAFTA has always been working. NAFTA was an agreement that helped integrate and make more globally competitive the three economies of the United States, Mexico, and Canada. We still have a lot of disputes because we have a lot of trade. The more you have a trading partner that covers a lot of different issues and categories, the more you're going to have disputes. And some of them are very long-lasting, as Bill points out. That's true. The modifications of NAFTA to become USMCA have reasonably succeeded. The U.S. Had an interpretation of automotive rules that turned out to be wrong. So I think that will become clearer in the future. But look, it is important to look at the benefits of having free trade with these two large trading partners, and the ability to essentially make things together and sell them to each other in the world, which is what we do in the NAFTA, and we still do it under USMCA. And for that, American producers and consumers ought to be grateful.
Speaking of having problems with our, even our best trading friends, we seem to have a spat with Mexico over steel. Can you tell us a little bit about that issue?
Yes. The agreement, part of the agreement, the USMCA agreement, was to remove the tariffs, the Trump Section 232 national security tariffs on steel and aluminum. And the idea was that Mexico would basically watch its exports of those items and make sure they didn't surge in response to the tariffs being removed. And now the U.S. has begun to complain because it appears that they are surging. And in the case of steel, for example, the historical period that is the point of reference for this is 2015-2017, and steel imports from Mexico are up 72% in 2022 compared to that historical period. And in aluminum, they were up 86% compared to that historical period. So I think I think the United States can legitimately say that's a surge. If you look at the year-by-year data, 2022 is not enormously different from 2021. Both are much bigger than 2020, but that was a COVID year, which sort of doesn't count. But it's certainly true that imports have been creeping up. And so I think that the U.S. is within its rights to bring the issue forward. Right now, they're talking about it, so it's in the consultation stage. There has been one bill introduced in the Congress to go back and impose duties. I think the more likely outcome is that people will wait to see what the negotiations produce. It looks like what the American side would prefer is some kind of a monitoring system where Mexico would keep track of their exports, which would allow us to intervene more quickly. Apparently there are transparency issues here and with respect to the data. One issue that has not come up, which is worth raising because it's common in other cases, is the extent to which this is Mexican produced steel, which it could be, or whether it's steel that comes from somewhere else, i.e. China, that is circumventing the anti-dumping duties that have been placed on, in their case, on Chinese steel. There's no allegation of that at this point, or no assertion of that, but I would think it's one of the things that the administration is going to talk to the Mexicans about, particularly if they think that there's a lack of transparency in the data.
Look, it seems to me that this connects directly to the story we talked about last week, which was Nippon Steel's attempted acquisition of U.S. Steel Corporation. And the way that connects is to look at the domestic U.S. conditions of supply and demand. What, in my view, what is happening is the combination of the Section 232 Trump-imposed tariffs on steel and the huge amount of spending rolled out by the Biden administration and the recent Congresses in infrastructure and Inflation Reduction Act and all the investments in things that are made of steel and the Buy American requirements that are part and parcel of those federal spending programs. So you combine restricting imports via the 232 national security tariffs, then you increase demand for the domestic product with subsidies. And guess what? Demand exceeds supply in the U.S. steel market in a lot of respects. So what do you expect from that? Well, first, steel prices go up and steel companies become more valuable. And so you get interest from a company like Nippon Steel, who'd like to buy some U.S. productive capacity to be able to compete for that Buy America restricted business. You also get a situation where our free trade partners like Mexico, that are less hampered by 232 tariffs, see that increased demand and respond to it. So I think this is worth a much broader look at what's happened to the steel market. And there are a few people in America who produce steel. There are a lot of people who use it, including the government and its infrastructure projects. And what's the best deal here for both steel buyers and sellers and the investments that the government's making in the space? I prefer letting the markets work. We've got the market constrained in ways that are driving the steel price up. So I'm not surprised to see the stories, but I think it deserves a little broader look.
So Bill has already mentioned the rapid response mechanism. That's the other feature of USMCA that we're discussing today. Scott, I imagine you also have a take on this. Do you feel like the mechanism has been an overall success for USMCA, especially in light of the recent panel hearing we're talking about?
Well, I know what it did politically, and it basically helped move the labor movement from no on NAFTA to yes on USMCA. So I respect the political calculation involved. I've always been a little bit suspicious of reversing the rules of due process. This one feels like guilty till proven innocent. Be that as it may, governments seem to be making it work effectively. The mining case that has come up with respect to the rapid response mechanism is a complicated one because it's been going on for so long. In fact, if there were any sort of Western-style statute of limitations here, I'm not sure the case would be before us. It's one of those things that it has such a long history and lots of ins and outs that I'm not sure what to make of it based on the facts. But I understand why the mechanism's there and its political value. I understand that governments are trying to make it work. But as my lawyer friends always say, hard cases make bad law. And this seems to me to be a hard case.
You know, if I could go back a step, there's an alternate explanation for the demand-supply equation that Scott drew out, which is that it's not a demand problem, it's an excess supply problem because of global overcapacity. And the steel is being dumped here because there's too much of it in Mexico.
Oh, I didn't think there was a dumping accusation there was a surge.
Well, not yet. Wait and see.
But there's not a dumping and there's not an injury accusation with respect to Mexican steel.
Well, I think the view is that the best way to solve the problem is to get the administration to do it within the context of the agreement. If you wanted to complain that it was being dumped, I mean, I don't know if it is, but if you wanted to allege that, that would be, first of all, a more expensive undertaking and then a much longer one before you get any relief, even if you were going to win. But I'm suggesting an alternate demand supply equation. The overcapacity and overproduction has been the history of the steel industry for years. And I'm glad they're building more stuff that'll maybe soak up some of the demand, but I'm inclined to think that excess supply is part of the problem as well.
Guys, this talk of allegations of potential unfair economic practices is a good segue into our second topic of the day, which is the United Steelworkers urging the Biden administration to look into potential unfair practices by China, specifically in the shipbuilding and maritime logistics sectors. So guys, tell us a little more about the United Steelworkers petition. What does it claim about Chinese shipbuilders? What policy changes is it calling for?
Well, on top-line basis, it notes the ridiculously small share of the maritime fleet that goes into service at any point in time that is produced in American shipyards. And in this case, believe it or not, I'm fully in agreement with the union. And I think the U.S. commercial maritime shipping industry is in real crisis and deserves the close scrutiny it's getting. It's really in perilous shape. If you look at the ships that are built in the United States, they're not the major container ships and large seagoing vessels. It's principally barges and tugboats for use on river routes. And much of that fleet is aging badly. So I'm actually happy that official Washington is waking up to the perilous state of the U.S. merchant fleet. However, I have a hard time blaming all this on China, because the story of merchant shipbuilding in the United States is declining competitiveness for about 100 years. The things we make in shipyards are more expensive and less flexible and less acceptable to a global market than almost any other shipbuilding nation. Koreans built most of the ships a couple of decades ago. They still have a very large share of shipbuilding operations. And the Chinese build a lot now, just like they build a lot of cars and a lot of other kinds of machines. So the U.S. has been uncompetitive for a long time. So while we may want to bring a Section 301 investigation, I would encourage the Congress and others to get another investigative group involved in what U.S. policy does to encourage or discourage construction of maritime vessels. I would contend that a lot of the problems with shipbuilding originate in the Merchant Marine Act of 1920, known as the Jones Act, which has regrettably, I think it was well legislated at the time, you know, many hearings, lots of fact-finding, but at a very different time in both American history and transport history. And regrettably, it was never forced to be reauthorized under any period of time. And so now you have a 100-year-old act that still sets the rules for U.S. vessels and crews, and that sets it in a way that we have become too expensive, uncompetitive in international markets, and has a lot of other costs through the economy. But look, merchant shipping's in trouble, but I don't blame the Chinese at all. In fact, we ought to probably get our own house in order first, or maybe simultaneously.
Guys, whenever we discuss economics and China, we inevitably have to say the administration's two favorite trade policy words right now, national security. Are there security risks associated with a decrease in shipbuilding?
Well, the odd part is the whole purpose of the Merchant Marine Act of 1920 was national security. This act was created to build a U.S. maritime industry after World War I, and it probably worked for a while. But I do think there's a national security dimension to this. I just think that U.S. policy, U.S. law and regulation doesn't do a very good job of fulfilling what our today's national security requirements are.
Bill, do you have anything to add?
I mean, Scott summarized it very well. I think this has a long history, and I think the most important point Scott made is this really predates China. I mean, China's clearly captured roughly half of the global shipbuilding industry at this point. But we were really done in by the Koreans before that, and we've been on a decline for a long time, not so much on the military side, but on the civilian side. And I also think that it's worth saying a little word about some of the remedies here, because I'm not quite sure what remedy would be appropriate. I mean, one of the things to think about in trade is, I suppose it's always fun to get revenge, but you really want to try to do something that will solve the problem that you've identified. And if the problem is that we don't have a viable shipbuilding industry anymore, then you want a remedy that will help restore that. And that means first you want to make a decision that it's worth restoring, which the government needs to make somewhere along the line. Second, the proposal not the only one, but the proposal the steelworkers have mentioned in particular is, let's have a port fee on Chinese vessels that land at U.S. ports, and then let's use the money collected from the fee to help revitalize our shipyards. I mean, part of me says, if you really want to rebuild the domestic shipping industry, it's going to take money. So yes, we need money, and if it's a national priority, then the president should go to the Congress and see if they're willing to appropriate, basically put their money where their mouth is and appropriate money to bring the industry back, which would mean subsidies, which means we'd be doing exactly what the Chinese and the Koreans have done. But we have to decide if it's worth it. I do think that a port fee would kind of miss the point, because what you're doing there is you're taxing the companies that own the ships. You're not going after the people that built the ships. You're not going after the people that have caused the problem. You're going after simply the people that are moving the cargo on the ships. And in the end, if you're going to tax the ship, it's going to end up being taxed, go back to the shippers, the people that are putting cargo onto the ships, which means that prices are going to go up here and it's going to be inflationary. I mean, it doesn't strike me as if you want to do something about the problem, it doesn't strike me as the right remedy. And I'm not quite sure what an appropriate trade remedy would be under the circumstances. I mean, 50 years ago, we could have done more at that point to salvage our industry and to try to level the playing field vis-a-vis the others. But at this point, when it's virtually gone, it's really too late without an enormous expenditure of money.
Look, Bill, you're right that this would take money. I just want to point out that what we do now because of the Jones Act ain't cheap. All right, if you live in Hawaii or Alaska or Puerto Rico, the goods you buy from the lower 48 every single day are more expensive because of the Jones Act. So that money is being spent elsewhere in the economy, not to mention what we go through to keep many programs that the U.S. government sponsors able to be moved on water with U.S. crews on U.S. vessels. I live in a building in North Carolina with about 29 condominium units. One of my neighbors is a very interesting guy who has spent his life in shipping, ran the Brooklyn Naval Yard for a time, and he invented the procedure to clean out an oil tanker to be able to use it as a grain delivery ship for Food for Peace. Now, first of all, that says the guy's a genius, which he is. I really love talking to the guy because he has such creative intellect. But what in the world are we doing cleaning out oil tankers to ship grain? And how's that a good use of taxpayer dollars? So there's two sides of this thing. And I think a serious assessment of what we do and don't get out of a 100-year-old law and the ways to modernize it over time that starts to bring it back to addressing national security issues. So I would just say, yeah, it's not going to be cheap, but it's not like we're spending nothing now.
It's also a lesson in the politics of trade, I think. You know, the Jones Act has been around for 100 years, well, more than 100 years now, because there's a wide variety of people think that it's good to protect our domestic fleets.
Yep.
I mean, we're talking about the long-term consequences of that, but efforts to repeal it or to modify it over the years have gone nowhere, and I don't see anything on the horizon right now that's going to change that.
Sad but true. You're right.
Happy note to end on. Guys, this brings us to...
you can count on the trade guys for light and happiness. In our episodes,
people. Yeah, this has been kind of a down session.
Yes,
you know?
That's right. We'll rename the program The Grumpy Guys.
and there haven't been no rants today, Scott.
I don't know. I guess we decided to take a week off.
Well, it was still gloomy, so I'll go ahead and forgive you guys. This brings us to the conclusion of this episode. Thank you so much again, and I'll see you next time.
Thanks.
Thank you.
To our listeners, if you have a question for the Trade Guys, write us at tradeguys@csis.org. That's tradeguys@csis.org. We'll read some of your emails and have the Trade Guys react to it. You've been listening to The Trade Guys, a CSIS podcast.